Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Michael O. Church was a software engineer at Google and previously for Morgan Stanley and for a number of startups. But he's best known for a blog in which he writes kind of uncomfortable truths, or at least uncomfortable opinions, about employment in the high-tech world, especially startups. Mike Church, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, it's great to be here.
My pleasure. Well, you've spent a lot of time in and around startups, and conventional wisdom, at least, is that startups have world-changing missions, are exciting, great places to work, and with potential to get rich. What are the fair-minded realities of it?
Well, there are two things to point out on that. The first is that the best companies and the worst companies out there are going to be small because they tend to gravitate toward the middle as they get larger. So there are a lot of excellent startups out there, but there are also some really terrible ones that will damage your career. Regarding the world-changing vision, I mean, that's marketing copy for the most part, because the reality is that they're on tight budgets. The venture capitalists are breathing down their neck to grow at extremely fast rates, and they have to be a business. They have to survive, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it's the same as a corporate job. You're there to make money.
But ultimately, they could still have the vision but try to make money. There's nothing necessarily wrong with wanting to change the world with their app, you know, even if it's got to be money-driven to satisfy the investors and them, their spouses, their financial desires or their own. What's wrong with having the financial interest accompanying the pecuniary one, the idealistic
one? There's
absolutely
nothing wrong with it. But the idea that these companies are out there to change the world as a foremost goal, I think, is generally untrue. I think the founders are in it to make money, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's just that it doesn't have a moral high ground as opposed to larger corporations that are more overt about the fact that they're businesses and that they're there to make money.
You also point out that, you know, you just said your first comment was really, to use the technical term, the standard deviation among small businesses is much larger than among larger ones, that you got really crappy ones because they haven't yet been Darwinianized out, and you've got the really great ones. How does one, if one is somebody who's a job seeker, what are the key differentiators? How does one of the signs is, as you're getting interviewed, as you're researching the company, how do you determine the probability that a startup is one of the great ones rather than one of the crappy ones?
That's really hard because investors, with regard to business models, investors don't even know half the time which business models will work, which is why they invest in a whole portfolio of companies. When you're deciding who to work for, you can't really diversify. You have to pick one. And I would say trying to evaluate the business model or focusing on the charisma of the CEO or focusing on the perks like the massage chairs, that's a distraction.
Of course.
You really need to look at the work and the team and the immediate manager, because those are the factors that will influence your career, your day-to-day life, how happy you'll be. And the other stuff is important in the long term. But in the short term, you just have to find people that you like working with and work that you like doing.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit. So the work, right, that's something that's that you know is there. If you're going to have to be working in Python at a very high level, that's, you know, that you're going to derive the benefit of that, that experience that you can then transfer elsewhere. There's no inference involved. So that, understandably, is a factor. Who your immediate boss is also a factor. The question is, how does, you know, in the interview process, somebody who's a good BSer, if I'm a boss and I'm really a jerk, but of course I want to recruit this hotshot, so I'm going to be really nice, I'm going to talk about collaboration, I'm going to go and be, you know, and I talk about giving you freedom and autonomy under a modest amount of structure, but provide support, and then in the end I'm a total jerk. How, any guidance on how to separate the jerks from the true winners as a boss, as an immediate supervisor?
I haven't figured out a formula for that. I don't know if one exists. I think that there will always be people out there who are very good at presenting themselves, but, you know, not what they seem to be. I think that some of that comes from experience. You know, you have to go into it knowing that sometimes you'll be wrong about people and that it'll be a learning experience.
I think you can determine a fair amount. I think in the way in which they respond, you know, they're going to have their pat little pitch down. But when you start to ask probing questions, and I believe the job seekers, just like on a first date, should be asking some probing questions about their potential romantic partner. Seeing how he reacts or she reacts under the stress of a probing question about their business model or the competition or whatever can be somewhat revelatory. And then before I accepted the job, certainly, when I was offered the job, I would say, hey, would you mind if I come and visit the workplace and chat out in the break room? Now, of course, the coworkers could lie, but you often get a feel about what this boss is like by just watching the way people interact with them, the way, and maybe if you're lucky, even some people will be candid about them, or even they could say, he's fine. That's one thing versus he's fine. It's just, you know, just a tone of voice thing. So I think we should not abdicate the sense that you can't tell. What's your reaction to that?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that that's a great idea if you can do that, if they'll let you go for, you know, shadow someone for a day or go for
I don't need to do that. I don't need to shadow them for a day. If I'm offered the job, if they're not willing to let me come and hang out to check out my work environment, then they're clearly hiding something. Any decent employer would say, hey, before, you know, if I say before I'm willing to sign on the dotted line, hey, can we visit, can I visit, can I hang out just for an hour in the break room or in, you know, in the work, see the workplace I'm going to be in, and then we can discuss terms face to face. Any boss who would turn me down on that is a loser. You buy that?
I would like to buy that, and I think that I would think that that's generally true. There are exceptions for, you know, I shouldn't say there are exceptions, but there are cases where, you know, a lot of these startups are very secretive, and they are deathly afraid that someone's going to steal their business model, and that's what the NDAs are for. And that's what some of the caginess is about. I'm not sure where I stand on that. In an ideal world, people would ask the hard questions before they take a job. But I think a lot of young people are so they're so desperate to get that first job that they don't ask.
Right.
They're so exhausted from interviewing.
Yeah, but my job is to empower those young or older workers to not just take crap and listen to the dog and pony show from the employer, but to ask hard but fair questions. And I do think that if an employer says no, and I really do think by being, you know, I'm not asking you to be, you know, really high maintenance, but by asking a few tactful questions and politely asking, can I visit the workplace and we can negotiate terms, you know, any boss who's, that's not being outrageous. That's just being modestly reasonable. And I believe that most employers would actually gain in respect for that candidate, because that candidate is not a little desperate toady. No employer wants to hire somebody who's desperate, even though in an ideal world they'd be more charitable. Do you really not agree with me?
I do agree with you. And I think I think that that's really good advice. And one other thing that have found works is to ask people questions where there's a trade-off. Because if you ask a question like, what's your stand on employee autonomy, there's an obvious right answer.
Right.
But if you ask a question of, how do you trade off autonomy against
right.
the need to meet deadlines, then you get a sense of where they really stand, because you're talking about, you're making them trade off between two good things or two bad things.
Yeah, more nuance there. I also, the point I will absolutely agree with you is, to do what actually every venture capitalist uses as a primary criterion in selecting who it's going to invest in, and you should do the same thing as a job seeker, which is, what is the track record of the people? Because in the end, the business model can be a bunch of BS, and the same business model in the hands of the wrong people is an utter failure. The same business model in the hands of somebody who's a producer, who's low maintenance, who's parsimonious with money, who's kind, who's ethical, etc., without being a doormat, is going to be a winner. So I would say that the most important thing that, again, we're coming just for the listeners who are just joining us, we're talking about how does a job seeker vet the difference, tell the difference between a great startup, of which there are some, and a lousy startup, which are many because they haven't yet been through the test of time. And the answer that venture capitalists choose and that I absolutely insist on is look at the track record of the people who are the central players in the startup. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. I think there is one danger, which is if you get lazy in the vetting and you fall down on back to reputation. My experience has been that, in fact, that reputation is probably, it's either zero or slightly negatively correlated with actual ethicality, because the people who are like the darlings tend to get arrogant. They get haughty. Maybe they were good when they rose up the popularity chain, but then they get there and they're very haughty and they can get away with a lot. So I think if you're just going on reputation, I would say that there's not much signal there, but there is a lot of direct evidential information you can get
exactly.
by asking the hard questions.
I did not say reputation. I want accomplishment. I want to look at their, you know, if they have done three startups before and all three were tanked within a year, that's telling me one thing. Ethics, I have to disagree with you. I think that people who tend to be ethical as a characterological trait, not something that they got one win and now they're going to be jerks. Do you have good evidence to suggest I'm wrong about the transiency of ethical behavior?
I actually should retract that. I think that, I mean, reputation can mean a lot of things. I think that the stylish people on the scene now, you know, sometimes we call them the VC darlings.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of unethical players there.
I agree.
But that's not a long-term reputation established over decades. That's being in the moment now, and that's a different thing.
Yeah, that's a sizzle of a steak. I get very nervous when somebody's too dressed up, when their PowerPoint is too polished, when they are just slick. They never say the word They've got their pitch memorized, but it doesn't sound like it's memorized. That's somebody who's putting too much effort in the steak. I'd rather see a more Aspergian, brilliant person who's got this true where he or she is really trying to sell this brilliant idea, even if he can't articulate it worth squat. I'm more likely to trust that the integrity of that person. You think I'm wrong?
I think you're absolutely right.
Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm having a conversation with Michael O. Church. He was a software engineer at Google for Morgan Stanley, so he's seen the big side, but he's also been involved in and around a lot of startups. We're talking about what it's really like to work for a startup. Because of the nature of the show and the listenership of KELW, we're focusing on the job seeker and his or her, how to empower him reasonably. Now, let's translate to, let's say let's be optimistic. I've looked for a job as at a startup. I found one that has passed my test. Good boss, good business model, good people, job that I'm capable of doing, not too easy, not too hard. Now I'm there. I'm showing up on day one. Is there anything non-obvious you want to tell me about how to get off to a great start in a startup that wouldn't apply, let's say, for working in a large organization?
Sure. So I think that when you join a startup, you should work hard. You should try to excel at what you're doing. I mean, that's obvious advice.
It's true in a large company too. No, I'm talking about anything specific to nonprofits.
Nonprofits?
I mean, excuse me, startups. Yeah. I'm spending too much time around KLW. Everybody's interested in nonprofits here. Go ahead.
Sure. So it's very common in a startup for people to develop a cult mentality where they're working 90 hours a week and they forget about their own interests and their own identity. And where you see problems with that is when people start making exceptions. They see things that are wrong, but they don't talk about it, and they're like, oh, well, that's because the founder's under a lot of stress. Or they start letting their own career ambitions just be brushed aside. Like, let's say they want to do Python, or they want to do machine learning, but they're getting assigned, a lot of compliance work. Like, you know, sometimes it's not even programming. And they take like 80 hours of grunt work thinking that they're going to endear people to them. But that never works. You're much better off keeping a focus on your career goals. And if the work that you're getting is beneficial to you and to the company, that's great. But if the company's interests and yours diverge and you only have like 0.01% equity, it really doesn't make sense to keep your head down and keep working on these things that aren't doing any good for you.
Now, there's a point I agree 10,000%. In large companies, there is an HR structure that's going to keep bosses from behaving badly, like making you work 90 hours, or there's an overall corporate culture. When it's a startup, it's, you know, a couple of the founders who are these usually really idealistic or money crazed young people with no experiences, no HR department, and so they can be jerks, and they can expect you to work 90 hours and BS you and whatever. And I think that's right. I think keeping your eyes on the prize, focusing on what is right for you, a reasonable workload. Are you going to be licking envelopes, literally or metaphorically, when you were brought on to use Perl or write in assembly language, as you say? It really is important to watch out for yourself. That's your point, right?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay, and I totally agree. Great point. What's another non-obvious piece of advice for working in a startup?
Another non-obvious piece of advice. I would say, related to that first one, is not to make exceptions, because startups are very intense places, and people step on each other's toes, and egos get bruised, and people are working a lot, and it's very easy. So the advice I gave of look out for number one, focus on your own career, that's advice that's very easy to hear and it seems obvious. But when you're in the field and everyone around you is a little bit deluded,
good point.
It's very easy to also become deluded.
Because it's part of the culture. Got it. And deluded that your 0.2% of ownership of the company is likely to pay you off if only I work the 90 hours.
Right. Right. And making exceptions, I think, is the biggest sin, because it's very easy when people are nice to you one day and vicious to you the next day and nice to you the third day. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say, oh, you know, he's just under a lot of pressure. But the truth is that people who have good character do the right thing, or at least try to do the right thing all the time.
But what if that happens to me? Let's say I'm a worker and my boss is nice 2 days in a row, and then the third day he becomes, you know, Godzilla. You know, if I, in a tough economy, if I go and call him on it, should I be calling? I mean, I would want to tactfully, gently call him on it and say, gee, you know, you seem a little different today than you were before. What's going on? You know, should I do that? Or do you have an opinion on that at all? I don't know.
Well, I think one of the differences between, say, software engineers and managers is that engineers, we're told by the compiler that we suck at our jobs. It says, this code doesn't work, fix it, or I'm not doing anything. So we're used to that brutal feedback that comes from the computer. But with a manager, they're not used to that. And you can't really say, look, this isn't working. And that's a mistake that engineers make, is that they very tactlessly go forward and say, this isn't working.
Right. So what do you do? I'm your boss. And let's say you've been yelling at me for some screw up in my code that really, you know, anybody's going to make them, but it really annoys you, and so I'm being yelled at. Now what would you, if I yelled at you, right? You're my worker. What would you then? What, given you don't want to be tactless, what would you say, if anything?
I think it's good to be measured, be professional. Sometimes you have a good relationship with your boss 4 days out of five and you can disagree, and sometimes you don't. And there's also a difference between a guy who gets angry occasionally and a guy who's actually working against you. Mm-hmm. But if you do have a company or a manager that's not with you and that's not helping you to achieve, you really have to find something else. And you don't announce anything. You don't fight back. You just start looking for other things.
Don't fight back, I think. You know, and I'm by nature a fighter. As you can see in this argument, in our discussion, we're having a back and forth. I'm agreeing when I can and I disagree when I must. But, you know, I'm not somebody who takes crap. But I've learned over the years that people don't change. So you and I are not going to have a relationship. We're going to say goodbye at the end of this half hour. And, you know, what counts is my listeners, and I want them to have a rich, rich experience. But it's my boss. If my boss, one out of 8 days even, you know, just loses it and starts acting, you know, is screaming at me or whatever, I'm not going to say a thing, because you know what? It's going to do no good. I'm just going to say, can I accept this level of, you know, this? Every job has its pros and cons. Can I accept this boss losing it one every 9 days or not? If I can, I'm just going to try to find my inner zen and, you know, internally try to stay calm or walk out if I need to. I might give him just a little bit of a look, sometimes silence. But looking him in the eye is about the most effective confrontation without saying a word, and yet unlikely to engender a verbal response. What do you think about that approach?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think another thing that people, especially the young, need to become better at is taking in information without having to act on it, without having to make a stand or go into it guns blazing. So if you see someone at your company do something unethical, Don't make excuses for him. Don't say, oh, he's a good person. He's just under pressure. You need to take ownership of that knowledge and assimilate it into how much you're going to trust people and what you're going to do. But just knowing something doesn't mean you have to act on it. You don't want to, like, make a stand. I've made that mistake plenty of times. Like you, I'm a fighter. I've seen something unethical, and I've brought it to other people's attention. And as you said, it does no good. I wish it did, but that's not the world we live in. And, you know, people who are starting their careers need to adapt to the world that exists, not the world that should be.
Yeah, I had a guest on the show who wrote the definitive book on whistleblowers, and 98% of them affect no change. So few that do, they make it onto CNN, but most don't, and they just lose their jobs.
And sometimes their reputations too, which is more dangerous, because losing a job, that just happens in the modern world. It's going to happen to everyone. Mm-hmm. If you're 22, you'll probably lose your job 3 times. For doing nothing wrong, but losing your reputation is more of a danger.
How does a boss ruin your reputation? If you call, let's say you've whistleblown some boss on something unethical, what do they do? Do they post something on the internet that and search engine optimize it so that anybody searching on your name is then going to find out that they think you are unethical or bad or difficult to work with?
Well, it depends on the kind of whistleblowing. The most effective way to blow a whistle is to sue. But if you do that, you can very easily end up blacklisted. I mean, I know people who have sued their employers or their investors in the startup world, and even if they're right, they're ruined.
Yep.
And it's unfortunate, but that's
nobody
how
wants
it works.
To hire a risk. And unfortunately, in employment lawsuits, when somebody files a claim of racial discrimination, sex harassment, on other kind of whistleblowing. Employers are just very nervous. They don't want an employee who's going to be a lawsuit waiting to happen because they can't really know what really occurred in the workplace. And so they say, geez, I'd just rather not hire somebody litigious.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a mutually assured destruction to those negotiations, whether it's whistleblowing or negotiating severance, because if you do actually blow a whistle, it hurts you and it hurts them. So there's this interesting game theory of, you know, is this person going to do the, you know, on paper rational thing and keep silent, or are they that angry that they're going to blow the whistle?
Yep. Mutually assured destruction in this context is a really good analogy. This is Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Michael Church about working in a startup. Not the obvious things. We're focusing on the stuff that doesn't make it into the ha-ha happy press. So hope you're enjoying it and hopefully finding it of value. I think what I'll do is I'm going to give out the phone number. If anybody listening has a comment or a question about working in a startup, we invite your call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and Mike Church, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the more interesting things that you blog about is this really an eye-opener for me. I love this idea. We kind of accept uncritically that bosses should tell us what we should work on. You don't fully accept that, and then it's not just a theoretical idea. You give the example of Valve, a really cool company. They make the Fallout series of video games. Tell us about that.
So that idea is open allocation, is what I've given it, which is where people work directly for the company. It's not a free-for-all of people work on whatever they want, but it's, you know, the company decides what at a high level is important, and then workers allocate their time and their energy to what they think will help them grow, what will help the company be more successful. And I think it works really well in software because the question of what problems to solve, because there are an infinite number of things you could put your energy into as a programmer.
Right.
That question requires a lot of data, a lot of information, and no one person has all that information. It's the people on the ground who actually know, okay, this will succeed, this won't. And so many of these traditional closed allocation companies where people are just resources that are, you know, essentially told what to do, they end up on projects called death marches where everyone knows they have a chance of success.
Right. A game that, in other words, the early market research shows the game is boring, people aren't going to play it, yet they got to play it, got to see it through to development to completion.
Exactly. And with open allocation, you're less likely to have that because if people won't bet their careers on it, it's probably not good for the company.
Exactly.
Ultimately, people in a private sector workplace, they want to make that company succeed because that makes them succeed. And if it, you know, if they're not, if they don't have faith in it, it's probably not worth doing. And, you know, it's not that managers and executives are dumb people. They're not.
Right.
But one person or a set of five people in a 100-person company, they can't make all the decisions.
Exactly.
It's just not enough information that they have access
to. Just a great example of crowdsourcing. You know, it has its limits. I would think that its limits are not of this open allocation are not limited just to software companies, but any workplace where there are people who are motivated primarily about growing and being smart and contributing to the company, but there are other workplaces where a surprisingly large percentage of the workers are merely looking for what's the easiest work I can do and how can I get home to go home early, and they may disproportionately, in a workplace like that, they might disproportionately just pick the easiest stuff, not what's best for their development or the company. Does that make sense?
It does, and you're probably right. I mean, I don't know anything about how Walmart works, so I can't look at Walmart the way I would look at a Google and Microsoft and say, you should do an open allocation, because I just don't know. I think that the difference between the new technological economy and the old industrial one is that in the old one, the difference between mediocrity and excellence was small, but the difference between mediocrity and failure was often catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to manage toward the middle, and you wanted to reduce variation. But in creative work, mediocrity and failure are pretty much the same thing, and the difference between mediocrity and excellence is huge. So you have a different payoff curve.
Great
point. You know, it's exponential rather than tapering off. And in open allocation, you have more variation of people's efforts, but that's, you're now capturing the upside.
That's
but
very
if you're running a factory where your goal is still to reduce defects,
right,
then I'm not sure it would work.
What a great, now that's a new idea I'd never thought about. That's exactly right. That, you know, with so much software out there, just take the world of apps, there's so many, let's say, weight loss apps. Unless yours is an absolute breakthrough, it's gonna lose. It has to be the category killer. That's your point, yes?
Yes, yes. And a lot of the category killing creativity comes from the ability to assimilate ideas from different sources. I mean, when I was 18, I don't have that story of having been a hacker since I was 5. When I was 18, I wanted to do creative writing, and you know, now I'm in software. But I've flitted around between creative writing, game design, pure mathematics, and I'm still finding the thing that I'm really good at, but I've been kind of good at enough things to have sort of my own unique perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And with open allocation, you have people moving around, maybe not in terms of intellectual disciplines, but certainly in terms of the company, and they learn more because you have that cross-hierarchical collaboration going on.
You know, I'm putting on my career counselor hat for a moment. I think you could do worse than having the discipline to focus yourself on this open allocation concept. Writing about it much more on your blog, you with examples, counterexamples. Don't be a true believer. Don't be an evangelist. Be a true, dispassionate observer of its strengths, weaknesses, and flavors. And then that will build your reputation in that space. And then I think you could be a useful consultant to companies who want to try it. What do you think?
That's something I've looked into. I've certainly, you know, I'm 30 years old, and I've worked in, like, depending on what you count and what you don't, probably 8 or 9 companies, which is a bit of a liability because it's the job hopper stigma. Mm-hmm. But I've seen a lot. I've seen what works. I've seen what hasn't. And the issue with corporate culture is that it's very hard to get data because you can't just go into a company and say, I want to do things this way to gather data to validate my hypothesis.
No, that's an academic approach. The way I would be doing it is much more anthropological. You know, I'd be going into Valve or another workplaces, trying it, and just get interview data, anecdotal data. You know, the value of such an entity is so complicated that to try to reduce it to an analysis of variance table is ridiculous. It's not going to happen. You don't need to. It's more valid and more fun to just do some interviews and get a sense of what's working and what's not. And assembling that set of anthropological data for a number of workplaces that are trying it, I think is going to get you more valid and more fun information and more likely to get you hired as a consultant. What do you think?
I don't know. I haven't tried that. I mean, I enjoy software. I'm doing some machine learning research.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what I'm leveling up on now, because
mm-hmm.
there's just a lot that I need to know. to get better at that.
You bet.
But there is a man, I'm sure I'm going to butcher his name. I think it's Yanis Varoufakis. I'm sure I'm butchered it. He's an economist at Valve, and everything he writes about open allocation and how it works at Valve is brilliant. And I recommend that stuff highly. Now, as for going into companies and finding out the anthropology, it's hard because, some companies are secretive and wouldn't let you in, which is fine.
True.
Because, I mean, they don't get anything from it. And other companies are going to say, hey, this is a way to market ourselves. But, you know, open allocation is something that I worry that as the term becomes more popular, there will be more people who say they're doing it than actually are.
Got it. One more shot at this. I kind of disagree with you writing it off. I would now do the following. Of course, there are going to be some companies going to be secretive, but there are going to be others, yes, who want the great PR because it's very worker friendly. If I were a software engineer and I heard that there was an open allocation company, I'm sure as hell going to want to work for them much more than somebody who's going to take much more control over my life. So I think there'll be certainly companies, especially those who are for whom it's working, that'll be happy to have you come in, especially if you not only say you're going to blog about it, but if you pitch Wired and you say, I want to write an article or Fast Company on open allocation, I would bet you that you would get an assignment, and then these companies would be dying for that kind of publicity. And that's what I think. I also think you should be contacting this economist guy who's so brilliant and ask his advice as to how you might adapt it. But there's a million assembly language programmers. There's a million programmers. You're a fungible work unit. They're going to find plenty of people who work for less than you want to work for in China and India. And I'm not sure that that's a smart, if, you know, I'm just playing my career counselor hat here. I'm not sure, unless you totally love to death assembly language, that you would find yourself ultimately as rewarded if you decide you're going to be the guru or a guru in the open allocation space. What do you think?
So I actually think, so right now the company I'm at is pretty open in that regard. And that's something I'm enjoying, because I think that as a programmer, if you're good, programming is an area where if you're good, you're not fungible. But you have to be really good. If you're just an average, you know, 9-to-5, do what you're told, write code to spec type of programmer, then you will be replaced. But if you really have the drive and the passion to get into the top 1% of software engineers, you're not fungible.
That's
true. You're precious.
Let's agree on that. Good point. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Mike Church, what's your question or comment for him or me? Hi, it's you.
Hi.
I have a question about... I work for startups. I've worked for several. I enjoy working in startups, but they're not static. You don't have that job, and that job is going to stay there. I worked for a great startup, had a great experience, very, very good access to management, all of that. But because we did stuff successfully, we got bought.
Mm-hmm.
And then that company got bought. And now I work for a big Fortune 500 company, and the complete culture has changed. The satisfaction in my work has changed. All of those things have changed as a result.
So why don't you just go to another, do some careful vetting and go to another startup?
I'm actually doing that. But I also saw the process that my entire team from the original company, one by one, start getting pushed out of the company, and I'm the only one left.
Right.
So I think what I would say about all of these, when I talk about open allocation and sort of the ideal workplace culture, the truth is that you can't be nice all the time and you can't be nice to everyone. And there are a lot of startups where the CEO is a really nice guy and he never steps on anyone's toes, and the people under him just become vicious, but he doesn't see it. And I think that startup culture is very fragile, and especially when a startup gets bought, if they don't put energy into protecting the culture, and you have to be a hard person to do that. You have to sometimes fight viciously to protect the people, you know, be a sheepdog that protects the sheep from the wolves, then that will crumble very quickly. And as you said, startups are constantly reinventing themselves. They're constantly changing. So if you're looking for it to be the same company 3 years down the road, it probably won't be.
Yep. Caller, I thank you very much for the call. We're just about out of time, Mike, but there's two questions I do want to ask you. I've carefully reviewed your blogs, and one of your more interesting ones, a little edgy, is you written about some guy named McLeod. I don't know his first name. He wrote about three types of employees. Tell us about those.
So Hugh McLeod wrote this, it was really a cartoon with the three levels of the corporate hierarchy, and he had names for all of them, losers at the bottom, clueless in the middle, sociopaths at the top. And those are all pejorative labels, and no one wants to be associated with any one of them, but there's truth in that caricature. And I think the losers are the people at the bottom who know that bottom-rung employment is a losing deal. They're not losers as in undesirable people. They know that it's a losing deal, and they'll work reasonably hard, but they're just going to do the minimum. And that's fine. They're rationally checked out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the middle are the clueless.
Unless they're intrinsically motivated. You know, even I know people whom I respect enormously who may be a shoeshine guy or cleaning toilets, but ultimately feel that all work is sacred and they will work hard and do a great job independent of whether it's dead end or not. And those are some of my heroes. I call them winners rather than losers. What do you think?
I don't disagree with you, and I don't necessarily think the McLeod cartoon is completely right. I think that there's a lot that it misses. I think it's a caricature of what happens to an organization when its only purpose is to sustain itself. And I think that at that point, the people at the bottom, what keeps them going is the safety and the security.
Yep.
And then the middle, the clueless layer, are people with sort of an unconditional work ethic. And they're dedicated to the project. Mm-hmm. They're very willing to subordinate themselves, but they don't know what's worth working on because they're just very unconditional about being hard workers.
Okay.
And they tend to make it into middle management and become sort of the heroes from the bottom, but they don't make it any higher because they don't have that strategic instinct.
Fair enough. And the third kind is the sociopaths. Tell us about them.
So those are the... I broke it down into the three things that organizations want from people. Strategy, knowing what to work on. Dedication, working hard. And subordination, which is more about... it's not being able to follow orders, because everyone has to follow orders sometimes, but putting the organization's interests above your own.
Mm-hmm.
And the losers are strategic and subordinate, but they're not dedicated. The clueless are subordinate and dedicated, but they're not strategic. And the ones called sociopaths are strategic and dedicated, but they're not really subordinate. Now, I don't really like that label because...
Yeah, right. It seems misnomer, no?
Yeah, because, I mean, that there's nothing wrong with...
Of course not.
...with being somewhat insubordinate. As long as you don't go overboard.
Right. All right. Last question, and I want to make sure we end on a positive note here. I really like this. You know, the popular conventional wisdom, especially of people over 40 or over 50, is always millennials. You know, they are really an entitled generation. Well, you have a much more positive spin on it, which makes a lot of sense to me, and you call them the disentitled generation. Tell me about that.
Sure. So the idea, first of all, I mean, it goes back to the dawn of time, people complaining about the rising generations.
Right.
You see that in Roman history.
Right.
So I don't put much stock in the fact that that exists because it's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of entitled, when it's used as a pejorative, is that someone believes in a social contract that isn't there, or they believe in a social contract that is there, but they don't want to do their part. They only want the benefits. And in this case, that social contract is the corporate paternalism, the idea that you go in, you pay your dues for a few years, and you move up the seniority system, and eventually you're calling the shots and your career is taken care of. And that social contract hasn't existed for 30 years.
Except for the top 1 or 2% of people for whom that game will stay. It works just often enough to make people continue to believe in that what is largely a myth.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, there are people who are going to beat the odds and be really lucky. There are people who are going to...
Or skillful, or really perfect for the game. Like, I know some people who are perfect for corporate America. They do know how to take crap when needed to. They don't mind that it takes three signatures to get to blow your nose. You know, they know how to kiss butt. They are smart. They work hard. And those people will still work, but that's not generalizable to the large majority of workers.
Yeah, absolutely. And to have a creative, innovative society, you need all types. You do need the people, you do need politicians for the world to work. You need people who can deal with difficult people and can get groups with different interests to agree on things. But you also need the insubordinate, rebellious types as well. You need the mix.
Yep.
Getting back to the entitlement concept, though, the reason I say that our generation's disentitled is because they know that social contract is gone, and they're not asking to have it back, and they're not asking for inappropriate benefits, which is what an entitled attitude would be. They're disentitled because they know it's gone, and they know that paying dues doesn't work anymore, so they're going off and they're doing something else. They're looking for opportunities to create, no matter, you know, if they get permission and blessing, great. If they don't, you know, as Grace Hopper said, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission.
Right. You know, I totally agree, but now I have to put my populist hat on again before I let you go. It's all well and good when you are really smart, efficacious, high-tech, emotionally together, low maintenance, all you don't have health problems, all the rest of it, you know, and you can say, you know, I realize there's no social contract, so I'm going to go and, you know, find my way in the world. I'll be my, you know, my rabble-rouser. But unfortunately, most people are, you know, in a hollowed-out middle class, which has been a theme of the show for the last few months. Your typical person, I'm not talking about your even bottom of the, you know, the low-efficacy person, but even your average efficacy, average drive, average emotional health person who doesn't have a serious disease, you know, saying the social contract is broken, that doesn't mean he or she is going to be able to thrive in that new world where there's no social contract. And I worry profoundly about the all but the top 10%. What do you think?
I am absolutely with you. I mean, first of all, I have had my share of health problems and difficulties. So I mean, I'm not necessarily in that privileged. I wouldn't even say it's 10%. It's 1%.
You're right.
And I agree with you that the dismantling of, you know, the middle class and the welfare state is an absolute disaster.
I think so.
That we've gone from being a world leader to being second rate. I mean, I look to Scandinavia and to Europe for more inspiration about the future. But I also think that from a pragmatic standpoint, you know, it sucks that a middle class family can't afford to live in the Bay Area or Manhattan anymore, or can't afford to buy housing. But from a pragmatic standpoint, what I'm saying is that it's important to recognize reality for what it is. And if and when people in our generation get the opportunity to make it better and to reopen society to a larger middle class, they absolutely should. You know, and I'm not saying we should leave people behind, because that's wrong. But I am saying that people growing up now, born between, you know, 1980 and 2000, the millennials, do have to realize that they have to take care of themselves, because in the world as it is now, no one else will.
I got to tell you, I can't help it. I don't know if I'm in a particularly pugilistic mood, but, you know, I don't give a crap if anybody can afford to live in the Bay Area or New York. Nobody has an entitlement to live in the, you know, Bay Area. There's nothing wrong with Montana or Texas or whatever. So that doesn't concern me at all. And I also am deeply worried about reallocation in the school. I'm very involved in the school system. My wife's a superintendent of schools. You know, all of the efforts in education are to ignore the best and brightest and to reallocate nearly all resources to the very bottom. The middle is also pretty much left out. No Child Left Behind gives all the incentives to put all resources, everything in the bottom. And that is a formula for reducing America to a lowest common denominator. So I'm not convinced that egalitarianism a la Europe or Sweden is the magic answer either. I would much rather see a dollar in the hands of one of those top 1%, than necessarily where there's going to be more likelihood of job creation and for the nation, than giving it to somebody who will at best, you know, be spending it on food, but unlikely to have ripple effects. So the problem is, I don't think there's a great answer. I think the best answer ultimately, and is for me, is training more people on the basics of simple entrepreneurship, not new software, but something like that there is potential for success and honor in doing everything from running a cart that sells imported soaps at the BART station, to somebody who runs a shoeshine stand, to somebody who's a sandblaster, to somebody who's an artisan baker, and that doesn't require to be in the 1%. For me, it's not the perfect solution, but it's our best hope for refilling that hollowed-out middle class. What's your reaction?
That's a lot to think about. I agree with you in general. I think that one thing that is wrong with our society is that we've as a society we've moved away from honoring and worshiping production to the worship of consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, we were once a producing society, and now we behave and think more like a consuming society. And that's how we rate people, is based on what they consume.
Yeah.
And I think that it's absolutely right that we have to, you know, the conversation we have to have is that, you know, even the lowest of the work, or, you know, quote unquote lowest, is admirable and honorable, and that the people who shine our shoes should be able to send their kids to good schools, and they should be able to provide a better life for their families.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Please finish. That's all right. I didn't mean, I thought you were done.
And I think that that's really what we... You know, there's a lot of mouth honor given to, you know, makers and production, but I think that we need to see it in our policy. We need to see a world where the people who help us day to day, whether it's driving a bus or, you know, repairing bridges, can live well.
On that point of agreement, I want to thank you, Mike Church, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. You just Google the name Michael O. Church. You'll get to his blog. By the way, I am doing 2 weeks. My guest will be a real heavy hitter in the world of the maker culture, where I do think there is some modest hope for recreating jobs. So again, Mike Church, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thank you.
Okay. I now return to you. We only have about 10 minutes left or so, but I want to give you a chance. If you want a three-minute workover, I can usually help you with your work problem, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, whether you're in a startup or you're in a big company or a nonprofit or government, give me a shot. The price is right, zero. So the phone number here for a three-minute workover on Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. It's emblematic of the times that Amazon is doing a massive amount of hiring while lots of small companies, you know, are being as lean and mean as they can get away with, and I guess every company is. But Amazon announced last week that it plans to hire, catch this, 70,000 full-time workers for its fulfillment centers to keep up with the increased demand during the holidays. That's a 40% increase from last year's seasonal hiring. So clearly, Amazon, no surprise, is booming. I mean, I went from somebody who 10 years ago bought nothing online to where I do almost all my purchases with even food items. I just bought lemon curd online because there was this great brand of lemon curd that's not so easy to find, and I wasn't going to traipse around driving around to gourmet markets to get, you know, lemon curd. But there in 1 second, I found the highest rated lemon curd that isn't too sweet. I read all the reviews. It's Hogan's, made in Ireland, and I ordered it, and it's on its way to my house. So anyway, Amazon, you know, for better or worse, you know, we all have emotional connection to the small little bookstore in the corner, Green Apple Books and the like. But certainly people, the humankind is voting with its feet. So you might want to consider Amazon also. They're fast growing companies that are here in the Bay Area. Most of them are tech. I just want to give you a quickie on each of those, and we'll go to the phones. I don't want to focus on the big ones that everybody knows about, because it's almost impossible to get hired by Google and Amazon for a professional-level job. But there are startups that are in growth mode, growing really fast. InvenSense, InvenSense, it makes tiny gyroscopes and accelerometers that detect motion in, like, tablets and phones and games and stuff like that. So InvenSense is a fast-growing company. Shutterfly, continuing to grow. Even in the Facebook era, people want personalized greeting cards and albums and coffee mugs. Shutterfly is the leader in creating that stuff. By the way, this came from Forbes magazine a couple of months ago. OpenTable, for some reason, I don't understand why people do it. I don't like it. I never use it. But for people who want reservations at fancy restaurants, OpenTable's turned out to be a big thing. They're fast growing. They're 10th of the fast-growing tech companies. Fortinet, based in Sunnyvale, they've been winning market share in network security. Unfortunately, the network security is becoming ever more required. They produce an everything-in-one-box kind of a firewall at lower prices right now. Fortinet, and I'll just do one more. Trimble Navigation. This is for farmers and engineers, oil and gas equipment. They got to identify location. It's a GPS system that that is designed for the industrial space, Trimble Navigation. Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi there, Mr. Nemko. I was listening to your show a couple weeks ago, and you made reference to a career field that you were unfortunately of the opinion wasn't going to go away. That was Homeland Security, and I've worked in that field, but I got tired of living on the East Coast, so I'm back in San Francisco. And I'm just curious if you have any suggestions on where to look for that kind of work out here.
Yeah. There is a job title called Emergency Management Services, and the city, each major city like San Francisco and the county and the state has emergency preparedness systems of various sorts. And they, you know, they are hiring. What kind of job specifically within Homeland Security would you be looking for?
Probably the intelligence realm, kind of scenario development and...
Yeah, that's perfect then. Good.
That's the thing.
Yeah, if it was lower level, I would send you, you know, to be one of the end of customs agents and airport security folks. But no, at your level, I'd be Googling emergency management services, San Francisco County or San Francisco, and find the website there, which will no doubt list the kind of services they provide. You will then find the division within there that's involved in more intelligence-related stuff. Because, you know, right now, for example, there are bioweapon detection monitoring devices that are all over the downtown San Francisco area, because clearly that's localized. Of course, it's working in concert with Homeland Security federally, but this is certainly, there are more under the radar but extant efforts in that area. So hopefully that helps.
Okay. Well, thank you for the suggestion.
You're welcome.
It.
Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Let's go back to the phones. I'll give out the phone number one more time. I may have time for one more quick question after this call. If you need some career help, you or someone you love, I do what are called 3-minute workovers. Sometimes they take 2 minutes, sometimes five, but they're quick. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. It's your turn. How can I help?
Hi, I was inspired by the last call or previous call about whistleblowing.
Right.
I had whistleblown on a supervisor who I saw on a government contract project engaging criminal action, and I thought I would get brownie points and it would be good for my career because I thought I'd be perceived as ethical. But I discovered the company's HR department had coded into databases that other employers use to search your background, the letters WH, which means whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out how, if you do whistleblow, you get past the potential blacklisting of having done it, where it may not have actually been as health of your career as you might have presented.
My way would be to do it in a team. You notice many of the most successful whistleblowers, certainly the ones that have been testifying before Congress, did it as a team so that they couldn't be blacklisted as the person. So if you uncover something, I'd find a kindred spirit for whom ethics is primary and try to get that one or two other people on board so that you're kind of protecting each other. That's my best shot. I want to take one more call, so I'm going to thank you for the call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you. Are you there? Last shot. Okay, bye. All right, I'll take this opportunity. I've got a bunch of tips. You know, so many of my tips are aimed at job seekers. I want to offer a few tips for people who are on the job. This is a technique for being a star at a meeting. One of the things that, for better or worse, people spend lots of time in the workplace and in is meetings. One of the things, and it's key to develop a kind of the sense that your comment is going to be respected. It isn't going to get lost amid everybody else's comments. And one of the ways you can do that is by shutting up for a while. On a given topic during an agenda item in a meeting, be the last person to speak. Not only will some of the people be wondering, well, I'm wondering what John is thinking about that, and you'll get greater attention, but also you will have had the benefit of hearing others' ideas that were good, others that were shot down, and then you can really seem like a leader by making a suggestion that builds on the others, giving them credit. Well, you know, you might say, for example, having listened to Jose and listened to Kwame and his idea about this and her idea about that, might it be a good idea to do blah? Now you're sounding like a statesman or a stateswoman, and you probably will get a lot of people's attention. So that's my tip, waiting for the end. Let me see if I've got another one for you. Let's see. Let's see. Okay, one more. In those meetings, you know, there is what I call a focus spot, the best place you could sit in, and that is where the person you most want to impress is usually looking. Every one of us, if you're left-eyed, you tend to look a little bit left of center. If you're right-eyed, you tend to look a little right of center. If the person you want to impress, usually your boss, is sitting somewhere, you know, where they're going to sit or where they normally like to sit, position yourself right opposite them or just a little to the left, a little right of the center. And if you don't know what it is, just watch them in one meeting. See where they disproportionately tend to focus their eyes. And, you know, that could be a very helpful tip. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah. No, I want to save that for next week. I got another tip I want to talk about. So many of my clients and people who I know who are long-term unemployed, we're not allowed to say this. We tend to just feel sympathetic for them. A lot of them have drug problems, you know, substance abuse problems. And sometimes it really requires this long, comprehensive, drying out program and a long program. But occasionally I found, at least with some of my clients, that all it takes to stop or at least moderate your substance abuse is to remind yourself of the one reason why you want to stop. I've had clients who realize they want to stop for their baby. They don't want their baby to be born with fetal alcohol syndrome, or they don't want to lose their spouse, or they don't want to lose their job, or they're sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know, whatever it is. But remind yourself of the one big reason why you're stopping, and then writing that down, saying it aloud 10 times a day. In other words, whenever you get a glass of water, remind yourself again, I'm trying to stop drinking because of I want my children to respect me, whatever it is. Or I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to be homeless. I don't want to be a bag lady. And then the other thing to do that can often help that doesn't require a 30-day dry out program that costs you a zillion dollars is to rehearse what you're going to do at the danger times. Like, my weakness is eating. And I got to tell you, I have not fully solved this, but there are danger times. When every day, as those of you regular listeners to the show know, I go on a very vigorous hike with my doggy Einstein around the Lafayette Reservoir. And after that, I am starved. I am ravenous, and I am already out. And so it is too tempting for me to go to Tomi, which is a wonderful sushi buffet that I love, or to Sweet Tomatoes, which is this, you know, soup and salad buffet that I love, and pork out and have 9 zillion calories. So I'm aware of that danger time. So I say to myself, as I'm finishing the walk, I say, okay, this is your danger time. You don't want to live with that lifetime of fat. You want to be skinnier. You want to go home. You'll also save time. I'm a time-conscious guy. So I would remind myself, you'll save time by not going there. Go home, make your stupid salad, and fine. So to reiterate, sometimes, occasionally, it may help. You can really help stop your substance abuse problem by reminding yourself 10 times a day of the big reason you want to stop or slow down, and to rehearse what you're going to do at the danger times, reminding yourself of how you'll benefit by not doing the bad thing at that danger time. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more 3-minute workovers on callers. And I will talk with Dr. Paul Ruggieri. He's the author of Confessions of a Surgeon. He'll talk about what it's really like to be a surgeon, and he'll talk about what everybody's got to know when a doctor recommends that you or someone you love needs surgery, and how Obamacare is affecting the way doctors are practicing medicine and deciding whom they are going to see and whom they're not. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.